convene, we have before us Representative Moses, Representative Wilson.
Moses, Roses.
Okay. Did I get it wrong again?
Moses, Roses.
You know, it comes out different than my mind says it.
I just thought maybe you saw me walking on water again or something. I don't know.
I'm still used to Carl and Representative Kawasaki. I never get that one wrong.
Heart in the seas, baby.
And Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Coring, and Representative Edgman. We have before us House Bill 165, Big Game Hunter Accommodations by Representative Ledoux. We have heard this in the previous committee. And we have a few people online that want to testify. Did you want to come up and say anything further? Representative Ledoux, by the way.
This is Representative Ledoux, not at this point, perhaps after the public testimony is taken.
Okay, and we're joined also by Representative Seaton, which gives us one member short of the full House. So I'll go online. Rick Metzger, are you available online?
Yes, this is Rick Metzger. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. I need you to identify yourself and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay, my name is Rick Metzger from Akiak, Alaska, and Representative Ledoux sponsored the bill at my urging to help alleviate some problems I'd run into in renting my remote cabins to hunters. And I did a lot of work with her Chief of Staff, Suzanne, and the Big Game Commercial Services Board in developing the wording for this bill. And I want to thank you guys for looking at it and encourage you to support it. And I want you to know that the wording of the bill was unanimously approved for endorsement by the Big Game Commercial Services Board, so I don't believe they have any concerns with it. So thank you.
You bet. That's very helpful. I appreciate your previous testimony also. Next we'll go to Dick Rohrer, Big Game Commercial Services. Are you there, Dick?
Yes, I'm online. I'm here in Fairbanks at the Big Game Commercial Services Board meeting. So,
is the meeting in progress as we speak?
Well, in another room.
You want to move the microphone in there?
No, that's all right.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and we've got your name and you're with Big Game Commercial Services and you're a board member also?
That is correct.
And the name of the board?
Big Game Commercial Services Board.
Just like it says here.
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Well, I was online when you first heard this bill, and I certainly concur with everything Rick said, Mr. Metzger. I can give you all the background, lots of background, probably more than you want, so I'll wait for questions for that. But just to let you know that when Rick brought his problem, when it surfaced, he brought it to the Big Game Commercial Services Board at our December meeting. And at that meeting, we put him with Kevin Saxby from the AG's office, Trooper Arlo, Trooper Loring from the Troopers, the Commerce Investigator Brian Howes, and Licensing Examiner. And so we had everyone in the same place to agree on what was needed for Mr. Metzger to rent his cabin. It was determined that the transporter license did not exactly fit what he wanted to do. It was determined at that meeting that the Big Game Commercial Services Board could not change a regulation, but that it had to be a statute change. And at a teleconference meeting with the board, Mr. Metzger, representative from APHA, and an area biologist with the Department of Fish and Game agreed that the simplest way to deal with this would be an exemption from the guide transporter law requirements for those who own a private cabin, lodge, or house that is located in the field. We would simply, if the legislature would concur that it was good to do this, we would exempt those private owners from the guide transporter statutes.
Okay, thank you. It's always good to have clarification in the statutes when the statutes could possibly be misinterpreted. We're also joined by Representative Guttenberg, makes the full committee of nine. I have one more person, Rick Ellingson of Kodiak. Are you there, Rick?
Yes, sir, I sure am. My name is Rick Ellington. I'm a commercial fisherman here in Kodiak, and I just wanted to speak for a minute in support of 165.
Oh, please, go ahead.
I'd like to echo some thoughts I heard last week when it was being talked about. It really is tough to make a living in rural Alaska. And I've known Mr. Metzger for quite a while now. And when he mentioned that's what he's thinking about doing, I thought it was a great idea. And he checked with all the appropriate authorities, and he saw a real need for a service that he could provide, and he went ahead with it. And then with just a couple word changes, the Big Game Services Board, I can't remember the full name of it, you know, they put him out of business. And it was kind of, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense, the ruling, I didn't think. In fact, from what I've heard, some of the troopers weren't even enforcing elsewhere in the state, and that's why a lot of people had a hard time believing it was really going on. So I was really encouraged that Representative Ledoux went ahead and wrote this bill, and they can put Rick and a few other people back in business. I know it gets pretty frustrating to have special interests and with the help of the government shut you down from making a living, and so I'd like to see this bill go through so he can get back in business and the other folks that want to also. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rick. Is there anyone else online that wants to testify?
Yes, one more in Kodiak.
Okay, name and affiliation, please.
This is Pete Hanna, and I'm a private landowner also in Kodiak, and I just wanted to concur with the new wording that's put in, and hopefully that will clear up all the problems. I'm just here to speak in favor of it, okay? Thank you.
Oh, thanks very much for keeping a testimony brief. Is there anyone else online? Going once, twice, thrice. Anyone in the audience here that wants to testify on this? Seeing and hearing none, we'll close public testimony. We'll now deal with it in committee. Is there anyone who wants to make a comment on this? For anyone, Representative Guttenberg?
Just a question. I'm sorry I came in late. The last gentleman said there was new wording. There's not a CS. We're just looking at the original bill. Okay.
I think that's correct. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. If there's no other comments from within the committee, would someone like to move this bill forward?
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move HB 149 with...
Let's call it 165.
Let's call it 165. Well, I'm trying to get out of here.
But there are some people in the back who really appreciated that.
A lot of people. The room cleared out. What happened? I'd like to move House Bill 165 with attached zero physical notes and individual recommendations.
Is there anyone want to speak against that or object? Seeing and hearing no objection, the bill moves from committee with the... appropriate stipulations, and my committee aide Heath will pass the yellow folder around to get your signature. Thank you, Representative Ledoux, Suzanne, and anyone else that was here to testify.
Thank
we'll
you.
Move on now to 149. Okay. And just by way of a reminder, I believe we already closed public testimony on 149. So be on some record-setting pace here. We have available for questions Cameron Leonard, the Attorney General's Office, and Lynn Kent, DEC. So if there's anyone in the committee that wants to address a question, and this is kind of a significant bill, I guess my personal feeling is we're calling it a states' rights bill, and that is to assume the responsibility for regulation in the state. It's hard to argue against that. I always think that we prefer that. We prefer it in a great many areas, not just this one. We'll do them one at a time. Representative Guttenberg?
Mr. Cameron, I'm concerned something we touched on. Are you there?
Mr. Leonard, Cameron Leonard, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Just checking. I often talk to myself. I just wanted to make sure I don't do it that as often as I do in public. Mr. Cameron, we were talking about the changing of the word from mandated to authorized. And what that led to was the difference between gathering data for a permit and simply gathering data. And my question and my concern is... The department often just does research on the side, you know, when the process might not be directly, or the EPA might have done research not directly related to the permit, the enforceable side of the permit, and gather data for the universal world of permitting and understanding research and understanding impacts you know, what we're doing in the environment and for resource development. I'm concerned about the loss of some of that research that might not be directly related to a specific project. And, you know, I'll give you an example. In the world of research along the Alcan Highway between Delta and the border, I mean, there's, you've got a lot of things going on, and some of it might be related to a project right along that corridor someplace, and some of it might actually be useful for amassing the world of permitting for a gas line going down the highway. So, you know, do you see the loss of research being a loss to the permitting down the road or other projects or understanding the world of the natural world in Alaska as it pertains to doing more research or more permitting for other projects?
Yes, Representative Gutenberg, through the chair. Nothing in this bill will change or diminish DEC's ability and authority to do that kind of monitoring, although I have to be frank, I'm not as familiar with those programs as Lynn Kent would be. I know they exist, and there's money available, including some federal money, to do those kind of water body assessments. This bill won't change any of that. It really just has to do with which requirements in connection with a particular project belong in permits versus outside of the permits.
Well, my concern still is who will do it, but that's fine for now. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we were discussing the bill the other day, there were some areas that we kind of danced around as far as making sure that it was very clear what was going on, and I would like to submit amendment. Is this a time that you were ready for?
I would think that would be fine. Go ahead and...
Okay, I move amendment number one, and I think it's you have it before each of you, and I would, rather than me explain what this is talking about, somebody from the AG's office is online, because we're making, I just want to make sure that it's, we're doing what we say we're going to be doing. So if you would ask for him to explain the amendment, I would.
I'll object to the amendment for discussion.
And so there's an objection. Who did you want to speak to it?
Somebody from the AG's office is online.
Okay. Cameron Leonard, is that who it is?
Yes.
Did you want to speak to Representative Wilson's amendment?
Yes, I would. Thank you. If y'all have it before you, I believe I have the same amendment here, and they both concern very sort of minor changes to two different lines on page 4 of the bill. And as we mentioned at the last hearing last week, these are changes reached after considerable discussion with EPA and to address concerns raised by EPA. The first one on line 4 of page 4 is the simplest to describe, and it's really just almost a semantic issue. I mentioned at the last hearing how EPA's concern was that our term waste material be as broad as their term pollutants, and so we had added what is reflected in Section 6 of the bill, a new subsection to our statute that would more or less say that, but they would prefer that we say includes pollutants as defined in rather than listed in, and so that's the effect of the first part of the amendment.
Are there any possibility that something that's listed would be undefined?
Well, the definition of pollutants lists a number of things, and then it has sort of a generic ending, you know, and other things like that. I mean, that's a paraphrase. So they wanted it to be clear that we weren't just including the things in the list, but we were capturing the definition.
Okay. I think that makes good sense. Let's go on to the second part. Following A, insert N, D, and we don't have D in front of us, so.
Right.
Can you tell us what that would be?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This, again, is a section of the bill that has to do with the state of mind necessary to pursue criminal violations, and as I testified last time, under the Clean Water Act, negligent violations of the Clean Water Act can give rise to criminal charges, although they certainly don't have to. That's within EPA's authority to do that. And so our statutes require criminal negligence under 790. Therefore, to satisfy EPA and to show that our program is as stringent as theirs, we're offering this new subsection I to 790 that basically says for purposes of this program, the APDES program, simple negligence is sufficient. The reason we're having to add and D is to clarify, this is sort of a carve-out from a carve-out, if you will. Under the existing law, D addresses oil spills, and if and EPA wanted us to add the words and D to show that this new program under I, where simple negligence is sufficient, would also apply to oil spills, since they would be a violation of the Clean Water Act as well.
Okay.
Question?
Representative Guttenberg has a question for you.
What is the title of Section 790?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, in the current statute, 790 is simply called criminal penalties.
And I think what we had was simple negligence instead of criminal negligence that would cover Class A. And this would also be under a Class A misdemeanor. Am I correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Representatives, I'm sorry.
We're not changing any penalties.
That is correct.
Okay. Representative Seaton has a question.
And it's a little confusing here trying to figure out what this does. Does this in any way allow the state to select a gross negligence standard or something other than simple negligence?
No, Representative Seaton, through the chair, that is what we cannot do. If we want to get the program approved, we can't require a higher state of mind than EPA does. Unless we want to, if we wanted to pursue a felony charge or some higher charge, we could require a higher state of mind. But for simple misdemeanor charge, we can't require more than negligence and meet EPA's approval criteria.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions?
On this point or another?
On the amendment. So we have objection to the amendment.
I'll remove my objection.
Objection is removed. Are there any other objections? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one passes. We now go back to the main body of the bill, House Bill 149. Is there any Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we on specific amendments or just questions?
You can go ahead and make an amendment if you have one.
No, I have some.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions were asked, and I wanted to go over those responses. One of them was that, a list of things currently within the EPA NPDES permits that DC is planning to put outside those permits if we assume primacy. And, the example that was provided by DEC is such as additional monitoring, including sediment monitoring, nearby subsistence use, and other studies that might help refine effluent limits for permit reissuance or to help the state revise regulatory water quality standards. And it seems to me if our intention is to move those things outside of the permit, that means that none of those things are going to be publicly accessible. And if we are thinking that we need that information for revising regulatory water quality standards, we are actually denying the public the information that's going to be needed to make those determinations. So I am concerned of the scope of things that are going to be left out of NPDES permits. And therefore not available to the public. And I was wondering if we could get a discussion from DEC or somebody on how we are not going to actually lose public information.
Lynn Kent, were you able to listen to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm online. My name is Lynn Kent. I'm the Director for Division of Water with DEC. Representative Seaton through the chair, the example that you gave there where we might ask a permittee to collect information that would help us make revisions, for instance, to our regulatory water quality standards, Those revisions are always public noticed for comment, along with all of the supporting science and information that we have that is driving a potential change to the water quality standards. So basically anything that we have in that regard is also available to the public.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, you know, I'm just quoting out of the example that was given here, and my understanding is that the desire for taking this primacy is essentially to keep things out of the permit, which keeps them outside of the, or at least one of the intentions, that's not the only one, but one of the intentions is to not have things within the permit requirement. And if it's not within the permit requirement, my understanding from the other questions is it won't be available to third parties. And are you saying that if you make requirements outside of the permits, that the information will still be available to third parties to propose additional revision of regulations? Or are you saying that if you look at that information and decide the revise the regulations, at that point the information would become public?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, any of the studies or additional information we might ask a permittee to do outside the context of a permit is available for public review.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and Cameron, I know we discussed this last time. For instance, on page 3, line 1, where it says "into any waters," and we were clarifying when we last talked about this, we were only referring to surface waters. Is there some value in us adding the word "surface," or does something already exist? Because you deleted surface water, not that you did, but the bill deletes surface water and substitutes water.
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, waters of the United States is the full phrase used there, and that's the phrase that basically we're required to use to make sure our program is as inclusive as EPA's. And we used to use surface waters, and their concern was the universe of surface waters is not exactly the same universe as the universe of waters of the United States.
And I guess that's where I rattle my brain. I mean, surface water or subsurface water? And
right. But if I may, we touched briefly on this last week. The federal definition of waters of the United States also gets into wetlands, which may or may not be within the definition of surface waters, depending on your perspective. So we felt we had to use their terminology to address their concerns.
Okay. And so in your mind, then, this bill does what we intended it to do, and that's to be able to deal with the federal government and take authority for enforcement?
Yes, as well as the permitting program itself.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Seaton has another question.
Following up on that, you know, we'd ask a question about the confusion between waters of the state and waters of the United States. And if we're not defining this in statute, I'd like to clarify on the record as to whether there's going to be confusion of what waters we're talking about.
Cameron, did you want to address that question?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Seaton, through the chair. I think that having adopted the federal definition as we've done in the regulations and then used that terminology here, that there shouldn't be confusion, except to the extent that the federal definition itself is subject to ongoing litigation and recent decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court. But there's nothing that we as a state can do to address the dynamic nature of federal law in that area. I think we've tied our definition for purposes of this program to the operative federal definition. And we've done it in regulation rather than in statute, but I think that it's clear if you read the statutes and the regulations in tandem what the coverage of the program is.
And I just have
follow up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had one other question, and that was I had asked the question, you know, one of the primary movers here was to, as I understand it, to move so that we would have less third-party suits for information. And, you know, I asked the department of how many third-party suits have there been about information that wouldn't have been included under the DEC's definition. And, you know, I don't have any answer. I mean, the answer was that they don't know, that they don't track the lawsuits either threatened or filed. And so my concern with this whole process is, my recollection is it's $5.8 million per year. I think it was per year, $5.8 million fiscal note. And, you know, I don't see that we're gaining, because when we get to budget reductions in future years between now and when a gas line comes on board, my fear is that what we're going to do is cut down and have less people. And when we start cutting down less people, we're not going to have EPA there doing them. It's going to delay issuance of permits, and we're going to actually slow down issuance of permits. So I just wanted to put that discussion out on the record.
Cameron or Lynn, is there some comment you want to make about that?
Mr. Chairman, this is Lynn Kent. The program, as we've envisioned it and budgeted for it, is a $4.8 million program. I would just point out that we were and have been already engaged in a permitting program and in working with EPA on their permitting program. The increase to the program was about $1.5 million, and that was the incremental amount that brought us the full resources we need to implement NPDES here in the state.
So I take it it's just not a self-sufficient program, and that you still still need some GF funds.
Mr. Chairman, we have full funding right now under our base budget for implementation of the NPDES program.
And as Representative Seaton commented, in 2, 3, 4 years, is that likely to continue?
Mr. Chairman, I guess that would be up to the legislature. We operate other programs under a primacy mode here at DEC, and all of the programs that we take on from the federal government are subject to ongoing federal review to make sure that our programs are funded sufficiently to do the program as if the federal government were doing it. So we'd be subject to the same review that other programs are where we already have primacy.
But you do receive fees for the permitting process?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the program is funded in part by general funds, in part by federal funds, and in part by fees.
And are you able to use your regulatory authority to regulate the fees to take up any slack that's needed?
Mr. Chairman, the fees for this program are set by a bill that passed a number of years ago, HB 361, that allows us to charge for direct costs of providing services. So that is a relatively set amount of the funding we can collect.
Representative Seaton?
And to follow up, just so we get it on the record, isn't the multiple that expected the fees to go up by 1.8% or almost doubling under this bill or under NPDES primacy?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. That's correct. Our direct cost of implementing the program, where we are not just certifying federal permits, but actually writing the permits and issuing those permits and doing the compliance work ourselves, means that our direct costs go up, and we've estimated that it would be about a factor of 1.8.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In dealing with the fees, I'm looking at the work group's recommendations. Is there a fee structure established? I mean, there was one established in 361. The request for fee structure advanced any at all in this dialogue?
Yes, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, we are at NPDES program approval. We will need to revise our current fees. We already charge a fee for our certification of the federal permits and the compliance work that we do. When we receive program approval from EPA, we will need to revise the fees for those industries and local governments that we issue permits to. The approach to the fees was established in HB 361, and that remains in place, and we'll use that same approach. What changes is our the direct work that we do that supports the permitting and compliance work will increase, and therefore the fees will increase. And that was vetted through our primacy work group that consisted of the major permittees in the state.
Okay.
So they're not surprised by that. They know that would be coming.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg has a follow-up.
Thank you. Well, not a follow-up, just another question.
Another comment.
Thank you. Well, that's a question. I'm looking at the large community comments and the recommendations from the work group that the large community wastewater groups are not supporting this. So could you give me some comment on that?
Representative Guttenberg, where are you referring to in the report?
Page 20, recommendations of work groups. VIII 8, right, the second sentence in the first paragraph. The large community wastewater work group member does not think that primacy will provide significant benefits to this segment of the regulated community and does not support primacy.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, the work group member who was on the work group at that point in time representing large community wastewater systems was actually from the municipality of Anchorage and the system that the domestic wastewater system here in Anchorage. And that system will actually, that permit for that facility will remain with EPA and will not transfer over to the state. So he didn't see a benefit to NCDS primacy because it really wasn't going to affect his facility directly. And I can, if you'd like, I'd explain or ask Cam to explain why that facility won't transfer to the state under NPDES primacy, but it's a portion of the law that keeps us from taking on a handful of the facilities in the state.
That, if I may continue, that's fine. Where is the break between large community and small community?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, we did not make any distinction for work group purposes on what was a large facility versus a small facility. We had a representative who was representing larger communities and then one who was primarily focused on the smaller village systems.
Thank you, Mr. I was just trying to get to the point. Is Fairbanks covered? Is Sitka covered? Is Wrangell covered? Is Dutch Harbor covered? Where was that break?
I guess he's asking if there's a fixed number that determines coverage or non-coverage.
Mr. Chairman, all of the facilities that have a discharge to a surface water body will need or already has an NPDES permit. I'm not sure what the question is other than that for purposes of our work group, we wanted somebody to represent the larger communities and somebody to have the smaller village perspective in mind as we went through the work group process.
Chairman, if you'd like, this is Cameron Leonard. I can try to respond to the question.
Thank you. Go ahead.
To the extent that I understand it. The situation with the municipality of Anchorage is unique in that they enjoy a waiver from the requirement of providing secondary treatment for their domestic wastewater. It's called a 301H waiver under that, named after that section of the Clean Water Act. It's only available for larger municipalities discharging to marine waters, so none of the interior communities would be eligible for that waiver. And I think, although I'm not positive, that it's the only facility in Alaska that enjoys that waiver. I don't know, Lynn, if that's correct, but that's my recollection.
And so clearly Juneau, Ketchikan, et cetera, would not qualify.
I believe that is correct, unless Ms. Kent knows better.
This is Lynn Kent. I believe there's a small handful of them. There are four or five that qualify for it, as I recall. We can, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to get the list of those facilities for you.
Would you do that for us? I'd appreciate that.
And I would just point out that those facilities still need to have an NPDES permit. It's just that EPA would maintain the responsibility to issue the permits and to ensure compliance with those permits. And we would continue to certify those permits, much like we do the permits right now.
Representative Seaton?
Lynn, would the fees for those facilities then go up by the 1.8 times, or would they, those fees stay with that, whatever EPA in the state charge?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the fees for those facilities would be the same as they are today, since those fees are based on us certifying their permits.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from Representative Edgeman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just to help me better understand this whole issue, and it seems like this is a pretty comprehensive piece of legislation. It certainly was when it was originally passed, and then the changes that we are proposing at the House Bill 149. But is it accurate to say that this legislation essentially deals with the state wastewater permitting program, I mean, top to bottom, more or less?
Lynn?
Mr. Chairman, I was only getting about every fourth word there. I apologize. I could not understand the question.
State wastewater permitting, top to bottom?
Ms. Kent, this is Representative Edgeman. My question, if I could, through the chair, was that as I read through this bill and get a better understanding of it, it seems like it's a pretty enormous issue, and I'm struggling here a little bit. But my first point was whether this the bill in front of us, whether it was all-encompassing and enough to the point where you could say that this legislation essentially deals with the state wastewater permitting program, basically from A to Z, more or less.
Thank you. I could hear that very clearly. Representative Edgeman, through the chair, the bill is all-encompassing in terms of wastewater discharges to waters of the United States. We do have other state authorities that require those who are discharging wastewater to the surface of the land or to groundwater to obtain an authorization from DEC, but that program is unaffected by our efforts here to seek NPDES primacy that, again, would only affect discharges to waters of the U.S. or surface waters.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, then a follow-up question would be regarding the memo on March 19th. On the bottom of that memo, it says basically that the Clean Water Act allows penalties of up to $31,500 per day per violation. And I guess, you know, what comes to my mind without sounding like an alarmist here, but I'm picturing something like the Pebble Mine.
Surprise!
Surprise. But, you know, using that as an example or as in a backdrop, what are we talking about here in terms of penalties?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd prefer to refer that question to Cameron Leonard, who's more familiar with the penalty structure than I am.
Yes, Representative Edgeman, through the chair. We do not have the same penalty amounts as EPA does under that paragraph of the letter. We're, under our existing statutes, able to seek to go to court and seek to recover up to $100,000 for the initial violation and not more than $5,000 for each day after that.
She said no.
Okay. Further?
Can I have one last question?
Do you want to expound on how you feel the relationship to this could affect a mine as big as Pebble Mine? And I mean, I'm always ready to hear what your thoughts are.
Well, no, that was my question to Mr. Leonard and Ms. Kent, was to put this bill in relation to a project of that scope, and it doesn't necessarily have hit one project, but just trying to get a better sense of the widespread impacts of this legislation and really how it would fit into something like that.
If I may, I'm sorry to jump in, but I feel compelled to correct myself on the record. I was looking at the wrong subsection of our statutes. It's actually $10,000 per day after the first day for this program. I apologize for that mistake. That's under state law.
Yeah, you'll have to make up the difference, you realize.
That may take some time. I'm not sure if I addressed the question, but I wanted to correct that misstatement.
Mr. Chairman, I can follow up independent of the committee process here. I did have one other separate question, if I could.
Surely.
And this is a question I think I asked the last time, or the original time that the bill came up, and that was, again, for my clarification, to have, I guess, Mr. Leonard maybe explain to me in Section 2 of the bill on page 1 versus Section 4 on page 2 of the bill. As I read Section 2, there seems to be a pretty straightforward statement that talks about, you know, that results in disposal of or discharge of solid or liquid waste, so forth and so on, that you need to get prior authorization from the department. So I understand that. Then I go to Section 4, and we're now in Title 46, under number 4 of Section 4. This is line 29. I see a discharge of solid and liquid waste, material, water discharges from the following activities. And then I get the statement, if the discharge is incidental to the activity and the activity does not produce a discharge from a point source. So my question is twofold here. Number one, why isn't a similar qualifier in Section 2? And then the second and relating part of the question would be, is this something that came from the original work group that's more, I would say, something that's in addition to the EPA requirements?
Yes, Representative Edgecombe, through the chair. These are, I mean, obviously the new language is indicated with the appropriate text there, but on Section 2, 100A is the general statement that those kinds of activities require authorization. Section E under Section 4 of the bill is a carve-out of exceptions saying, you know, these are not covered under A because we're specifically exempting them. So under 4, those activities are all exempt from the requirement of getting an authorization unless they result in a discharge into waters of the U.S. So, for example, discharges to land or discharges to groundwater would not need prior state authorization under this, even though direct discharge into a water of the U.S. would. I don't know if that helps.
It doesn't. And one follow-up through the chair would be, you know, if the discharge is incidental to the activity, who makes that determination?
Representative Edgecombe, through the chair, someone at DEC presumably would have a judgment call to make.
Can we hear from Ms. Kent on that point, Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Kent?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Our permit staff would make that decision when we either hear from someone asking whether or not they need an authorization from DEC or from a public complaint where somebody might be questioning what somebody else is doing and whether or not it requires a permit.
I have a question for you. On page 2, line 25, the words that we added were publicly owned treatment works. Is that the same? Does that mean only government owned?
If I may address that, Mr. Chairman, that's a term that is defined in federal regulations, and it is governmentally owned, although it often is municipally owned. It does not include privately owned treatment works.
So even if we had a privately owned treatment works that was larger than a similar government-owned treatment works, there is this exclusion?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and this was a point we tried to extend the scope of this exemption to include privately owned treatment works that have been authorized by the department, but because that would have gone beyond the exemption under federal law, it could not be approved by EPA.
I see. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. On page 3, line 19, where we've got this addition, this is a talking about firing ranges or rifle ranges, and then we are adding, unless it results in discharge of the water to the United States. Does this mean that if you have a skeet or trap range and the pellets go over into wetlands, or if you have a shooting range that goes out over into the water, that now we're going to be, those are going to be non-exempt, and DEC will require a NPDES for lead into those areas?
Mr. Chairman, this is Lynn Kent. Representative Seaton, those facilities are required today to get an NPDES permit from EPA. So this doesn't change the requirements for obtaining an NPDES permit for a firing range.
Okay, and a follow-up. Then I guess the current law, as it reads, it says they're exempt. And now we're adding unless it results into a dust charge into the waters of the United States. Doesn't that mean we're changing from an exemption for shooting ranges into a non-exempt if it has anything to do with water?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, the firing of munitions, remember that this section of the bill or of the state statutes includes disposal of liquid and solid waste to the lands and waters of the state. So this exemption was to remove the requirement to get a state authorization for firing munitions at a firing range. But because EPA's NPDES permit program requires an NPDES permit for firing into waters of the U.S., our state NPDES program has to be as stringent as EPA's. So we maintained this carve-out so that a permit isn't required for a firing range that discharges to land, but a permit under the NPDES program run by EPA and or the state does require an NPDES permit.
I'm going to ask you a question that goes along this line. Not too many years ago, Eagle River had a firing range, and they discovered quite a lot of dead waterfowl. They attributed it to the firing of munitions. And, of course, the lower end of Eagle River is right next to the inlet. And I'm not sure if they abandoned that as a firing range or not. But if you fire munitions that land in wetlands, which ultimately, I don't know what doesn't, wind up in the waters of the United States, does that pretty much nullify everybody from doing anything every time?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that EPA required the Eagle River Flats to apply for an NPDES permit for their range, and I believe it's still an active range. I don't know, and I suspect that EPA did not issue a permit, but I think they did require a permit application to be submitted.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment that in Cisco we have a firing range that is over the waters. Okay. I think they had to change some makeup of the shot.
Steel shot instead of lead shot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite a round of conversation. Anyone else want to testify? Okay. Anyone want to propose that we move this bill?
Would Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Would like to move HB 149. I'm on the right one this time, right?
Same as last time.
With amendments, attached zero physical notes, and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, 149 moves from committee. And then lastly, we're going to deal with some pipe corrosion.
That's not an issue here, is it?
No, the pipe did corrode.
I'm pretty sure there's no issue there.
No cans of paint or anything. So we have before us a committee substitute. Okay. We have before us committee substitute for 128 oil and gas, but we need to have someone move that we bring this up before us.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Representative Seaton.
If I'd move CS for House Bill 128-25-LS-0561-K for discussion.
There an objection? Seeing and hearing none, we have CS for House Bill 128 before us. Would like to note, I was trying to count the number of sponsors here, and it went to two entire lines of small print, so a lot of legislative support for this.
21.
21.
What a magic number.
Do we need
to hold
that.
A hearing?
That's right.
I would like to move.
Okay. You can't leave. We have several people that are want to testify on this, and the sponsor, or almost sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff, to Representative Olson. The bill before you, House Bill 128, is an act relating to allowable lease expenditures as they relate to the recently passed PPT tax structure. There were really two reasons for the crafting of the bill before you. One was really to close that perceived loophole in 4355-163 that specifies lease expenditures that are not available for credit or deduction against the PPT. And because the sponsor feels that it's not right for the people of Alaska to be ultimately held responsible for the expenses of repair or replacement of either property or equipment that is either improperly or just flat not maintained. And this bill would plug that hole. It's not the intention of the sponsor, of Representative Olson, to open up the entire PPT. I think everyone here that participated last year has had quite enough of PPT. There's no intention to open the bill to try to bring it back to gross, to do anything. It is simply trying to plug that little loophole. The original bill had a minor change. It brings it in the form that you see before you, the CS from it was adopted in Representative Coring's committee, oil and gas, that does some minor changes to the language. You can see on page 3 of the bill. Added in, let me flip back here. It added in the Commissioner of DNR and opened up to the entire AOGCC. Did some other minor language changes and added in a provision that would also cover equipment that was not maintained. It was felt that that no maintenance was just as bad as improper maintenance. Mr. Chairman, really that's the extent of the bill. We have available in the audience Mr. Don Bullock,
okay,
from Ledge Legal. We also have online a number of people from Department of Revenue, Division of Oil and Gas, and I believe the committee members also have before them an amendment that has been suggested by Department of Revenue, some of the other departments, and we've had drafted up. If the committee chooses to adopt that amendment, the sponsor would be more than happy.
We'll probably get to that. I do have a question for you, because you used the words "not right," and that's intriguing to me. Because there's lots of times we see something and we say, hey, that's just not right, but is it legal? And so I guess I'm asking you, did the oil companies, in failing to properly maintain, and we haven't defined that yet, do something that was not right or actually illegal?
Mr. Chairman, when we get into to legal things, I should probably defer to Mr. Bullock from Ledge Legal.
Okay. Not ready to commit. You don't have that law degree?
No, sir. No, sir. As my understanding of reading the initial PPT legislation, at this time, if an oil company does not properly maintain, for instance, a transit line, it's not maintained, they go through and repair that. Due to their improper maintenance, they are causing expenses that would ultimately be deductible from their PPT, their oil and gas production tax.
And I may get into other people, but expenses are deductible. Correct? I mean,
correct.
The whole idea was the net profits tax. Expenses are deductible, maintenance is deductible, and repairs are deductible, and probably replacement is deductible. At some point, I just want to have some things answered so we're on firm legal ground about whether or not what the oil companies did not do was a violation that would cause us to say, essentially to offer a bill to remove their ability to take deductions. And that's, I know it's not for you to answer that, although you are representing the sponsor. But we do have some people from AOGCC, Oil and Gas, DEC, DOR, et cetera, ready to testify to us. So I'll just move on to them. Do we have someone in the audience here that will be testifying on this?
Mr. Don Bullock from Ledge Legal is here for any committee questions that may be able to address
questions. Okay. John Iverson, DOR, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chairman. This is John Iverson.
It says answers only. Is that correct?
Certainly, or I can, if you'd like me to make some commentary on this, I can do that as well.
I do. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Members of the committee, through the chair, the Department of Revenue supports this bill. I would like to clarify that the administration supports excluding these costs from being deducted or from being allowed as credits. Although the current law, depending on the factual circumstances, would give us the ability to exclude costs that are, for instance, attributable to gross negligence, so arguably some of these costs would be excluded or all of them potentially excluded under the current law. The reason we support this is because this clarifies what the actual status of the law is. It would add strength to any regulation that we would write that would say costs attributable to improper maintenance are excluded from either being deducted or from being allowed as credits. That's not to say, like I said, that we can't exclude them under current law, but if the legislature wants to have a more bulletproof, very clear way to get at these costs, to exclude them, then it is our position that that needs to be done in the statute, because if we wrote a reg under the current law, that would be subject to legal challenge. Whether that challenge would be successful, I certainly can't answer that. I think that would remain to be seen in a court of law, but in any event, it clarifies what is and what is not excludable or deductible. As to, I would like to also state for the record, I've had some conversations with Mr. Bullock on this, as to our interpretation of sections B and C of the bill. B, to us, the way that we're interpreting it at this point, and we would ask for some legislative clarification if we're wrong as to our current interpretation. It's my understanding that B goes to costs incurred to maintain operational capability of facilities or equipment during a shutdown due to improper maintenance or, for that matter, some sort of poor oil field practice. And in other words, an auditor would essentially completely exclude all operating costs for equipment or facilities during a shutdown when that shutdown is due to improper maintenance or a lack of maintenance. For that matter, C, and that would be a shutdown to address a provision to address a complete shutdown. C would kick in during times of, this is again our interpretation, kick in during times of diminished production. When, for instance, production is reduced by a half due to improper maintenance, but the costs of running the operation are only cut down, for instance, to one-third. So in that scenario, the portion that the reduction in cost does not track the reduction in production, that portion would be excluded. That portion of cost would be, of operating costs would be excluded. So in other words, your auditor would exclude an operating cost to the extent that the percentage reduction in production is greater than the percentage reduction in operating costs when that production is reduced due to failure to properly maintain the property. That said, we also, this bill incorporates one of our suggestions earlier on, the language taking into consideration the first paragraph of the bill. We asked for that language to be in there in case the standards really don't apply to whatever the situation is. Essentially, that gives us more flexibility. The original language was relying on. We asked that to be changed to take into consideration. That has been done, and that gives us more flexibility to have the discretion to whether to consider or to give a certain amount of weight to any given practice, depending on the circumstances.
You know, the question always comes to me. It's easy to want something, and we want the pipe to be maintained properly. The trouble is when we try to put it in writing, and when you use the when we have words like not maintained, that's pretty clear. No one was around, and nobody noticed anything until a big hole showed up and there was oil on the ground. But improperly maintained, wholly different universe. Because somebody has to define proper versus improper. And I bet it, within this committee we could have divisions over what constitutes proper versus improper. Then another point was, if indeed a company saved money, let's say they saved $100 from improper maintenance and then spent $100 on fixing the improper maintenance, should they be penalized? If indeed that's a wash in money, those are just some of the early questions that came up of not being able to define things and not being able to come up with a concrete written document that pretty much established this is what you will do. Now, if we say, listen, you have to have a visual observation of the pipe entirely. Once every 24 hours, that's okay. We can do that, but that still wouldn't prevent corrosion, or even notice corrosion. So, as we progress through this bill, I know it's got 21 sponsors. I know it's pretty clear where the bill is going to wind up. But I think it's good opportunity for us to have some testimony and have some discussion on the significance of some of the statements that are in the bill. So we can go to sleep with a better understanding of a strong support or a weak support. With that, John Norman, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I'm sorry. Let me hold you up there 1 second. Representative Roses had his hand up for a question.
Thank you very much. This is a question, for example, from the Department of Revenue. In terms of the deductions that are allowed along the process for the companies, are they allowed to depreciate the line? And do they take a depreciation off their corporate taxes or off of their PPT taxes?
Representative Rosen, through the chair, capital expenditures under PPT, such as a replacement of a pipeline, for instance, are both deducted immediately and subject to a credit. So there's not a depreciation type expense under the net profit scenario.
But from the original standpoint, if there were no repairs or no replacements, is the line itself a depreciable commodity?
Representative Rosen, through the chair, the answer to that's no.
It isn't. Okay. The reason I asked the question is because if you had something that was depreciable, and you've gotten down, and let's say it had a 15 or 20-year depreciation schedule on it, you get down to the 18th or 19th year, and then we determine because of negligence they have to replace the pipe, which basically, according to its economic value, only had a year left on it anyway. Do we then disallow the entire amount of that repair when, in essence, if they waited a year, they could have replaced it anyway? And so the concern I had in asking the question was one of equitability. I understand the intent of the bill, and I certainly don't disagree that we ought to reward negligence, but I thought in the PPT that there was wording in there that any negligence was disallowed to begin with, and you brought that out in your opening statement. So that was the reason for the question. So thank you very much.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have kind of a follow-up question. In your estimation, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. If I was a company and it was very, very costly for me to maintain something, and maybe I could get by with not doing something for a long time, but it wouldn't make any difference because when I did have to fix it, I got to deduct it. Versus, I can't deduct it, so I better maintain it the way it should be, because if I have to fix it at the end, you know, later on down the road, that's going to be a bigger expense, and it's going to come out of my pocket, and I don't get to deduct it. And to me, those two scenarios are two pretty big differences. And what do you think on those?
Through the chair, most of those types of decisions, in my mind, would be more of a business-driven decision than a tax-driven decision. I don't think particularly as well as a practical matter, most of these, the equipment that's at issue here was put in before PPT was enacted.
It still falls under PPT rules, I assume?
Yes, that's correct. But I was referring more to the decisions that were made in originally,
right,
in making decisions as to whether to maintain the property, how the property is maintained, that sort of thing.
And I guess what I was saying is, do you think that this would make a difference from now on? You know, as a business decision, when they're thinking whether they can maybe get by with something for a while, or maybe they better take care of it as it goes along, do you think those are decisions? If it's not a tax decision, then it might be a business decision. Do you think this bill would make enough of a difference that it would be heeded, or what?
Well, through the chair, I think the bill would make a difference in that it improves the incentives, and it as a policy matter, it kind of pushes the incentives in a certain direction, which is towards proper maintenance and giving a limit as to where the credits will be allowed and whether these kind of costs would be deductible.
Okay, thank you.
Let me follow up on my question.
Representative Roses.
Thank you very much. Through the chair. I guess where I'm having trouble with the bill, the concept I understand, and I understand from your explanation that even though negligence is already not disallows a deduction, I think your statement was that putting this language in would help clarify it, would make it easier. But the minute that you put a retroactivity statement on this, you now have gone back and changed the situation as a result of something that occurred rather than predicting this prior to its happening. So I think I wouldn't have a problem with saying, okay, we need to clarify it in the future. But in terms of what's happened in the past, I think if you got a negligence in there, then it's on the responsibility of the state to go after them and prove negligence, as opposed to say, let's change the law and go back and make this retroactive so that we can now understand what we didn't understand before and clarify what we didn't clarify originally. So I always have difficulty with retroactivity on issues because we enter into agreements with a certain set of standards. We enter into agreements with a certain set of guidelines. And then after something happens, then we want to go back and change things after it's already occurred. And I understand the reason for this, and I absolutely 100% support it, except for the retroactivity piece. We should have maybe done a better job of predicting this difficulty of clarification in the beginning. So it doesn't mean I won't vote for this when it hits the floor, but at this point I'm not overly fond of retroactivity.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to follow up on Representative Rose's idea of depreciation. If you have something in the oil field that is designed for a useful life of 30 years, and that's the expected agreement with the state that they're building something for 30 years, and it gets to 30 years, under this provision, if then something happens to it, even though it it went through its full design life, that it is now considered non-deductible because it didn't, people didn't expend a lot of money to get a lifetime beyond its expected life? Is that what this is really getting at?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, one thing, two points with that. One that I just want to make sure that was clear is under the current law, we're able to exclude costs due to gross negligence. There was a statement made regarding just regular negligence, and the actual wording of the current law is gross negligence. That said, in regard to your other question as to the term, it's really a facts and circumstances type determination, and you know, as to whether a technology is constantly changing, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Department of Natural Resources and the AOGCC are involved in this, because they would have the ability to evaluate sort of based on maintenance standards whether a pipeline would reasonably be expected to last a certain age as technology changes. And I think they would probably speak more to that. I'm certainly no pipeline expert, but I think that that's one of the real inputs here.
You know, the beauty is none of us are experts on pipelines, but we are, all of us are experts on maintenance. We make these decisions among ourselves every day on whether or not we drain water from our hot water heater, check the oil in our car, take a look at the filters in our furnace, and are willing to suffer the consequences of not doing it every single day, knowing that every month or every year is adequate. And so we're looking at a pipe now with, I don't know, a 30-year life. As this was, this pipe 30 years old at the time that it discovered corrosion? And could anything have been done to extend it to 35 years? And indeed, at the end of 35 years, it would have needed to be replaced even with the maintenance. So, and I'm asking you for just ideas on, are we going a little bit too far in penalizing a company for failing to do a certain amount of maintenance, not knowing what the right amount was?
Through the chair, one thing that I think is important to remember is that under the PSIO within DNR, the quality assurance plans that will be required under that program should address, it's an ongoing maintenance type plan, which should incorporate revisions to life expectancy and related revisions to plan maintenance based on technology and sort of the process of time and how things evolve. I'm not sure if that answers your question. If it doesn't, I'll certainly clarify if you have a follow-up.
Okay, and you mentioned PSIO, and I know people, a couple here are familiar with LAMECO and how PSIO took its place. But basically, LAMECO was an emergency order to deal with something, and PSIO is our long-term way that we're going to manage this. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I should really defer on that. We've got Joni Slemons here with me from DNR, and she would be very able to talk on that issue if you would like.
Sure.
Thank you. Through the chair, the LAMECO, the Lease Monitoring and Engineering Integrity Coordinator's Office, was not actually an emergency order, although it may well have had that appearance, because it was initiated immediately after the August shutdown of a portion of Prudhoe Bay. It was, in fact, intended to be a long-term plan and a long-term project, and the PSIO replaces it not to distinguish between an emergency and a long-term program, but rather to distinguish between the scope of the two programs, which is significantly different from an administrative point of view, not from a functional mission perspective. I hope that clarifies.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I guess I'm trying to get a little handle on this as far as So the idea here is that if anything ever has to be replaced, and it didn't have proper maintenance, then it may not be deductible. Is that correct? And that'll be the determination by the commissioners. Let's, whether it's pumps or valves or well casings or anything else, if there was any possible way they could have extended the life of that, and not whether it's an emergency shutdown, but if it just has to be replaced, then this calls into question whether that's going to be deductible and creditable. Is that correct?
Through the chair, this is John Iverson again. It does call that into question, although I think that needs to be made clear perhaps by the legislature as to how far this, perhaps just on the record as to how far that determination should go. Certainly improper maintenance will be called into question, but it may not necessarily be only an issue of extending the useful life. It may just be a, you know, random breakdown that doesn't really actually affect the useful life. It's just something that's needed for repairs.
And following up, well, we're not even necessarily talking about breakdowns, are we here? If something is being replaced, anytime anything is being replaced, it's going to have a capital credit. If it's being replaced because it's worn out, and especially if it's a high price item such as a pump station or some, you know, a major part of a pump station or something, and if it's not, if it's showing wear and tear that could have been maintained differently, or we expect it could have been maintained differently to extend its useful life, doesn't that call into question the deductibility and the credibility of that capital expenditure and operation money?
Through the chair, I think that's correct, with the caveat that the issue is not necessarily, it's whether it achieves its useful life, not necessarily whether it's extending its useful life.
Then back to my original question about the 30-year life expectancy or design life of the facility. If you had a 30-year design life on the facility, and if it exceeds that 30-year design life, then we're now going to disallow the operating and, or we have the possibility of disallowing the capital replacements, or not?
Through the chair, I think that is an option in either case. It really would, I would just have to say that it would depend on the facts of any given case. I mean, the actual useful life of an item when it's put in may change depending on technology and actual practices in the field. So, and actually, and Rob Mintz had a comment here. He's an attorney helping us here on this matter, and he had a comment on that issue too, if I may.
Does he want to speak right now on this?
Yes, he would.
That would be helpful. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, this is Rob Mintz. I'm an attorney with the law firm of K&L Gates, and I'm working with the Department of Law and the Department of Revenue on production tax matters. If I'm correct in interpreting Representative Seaton's question, I think an example would be if, for example, a facility has an expected useful life of 25 years, but because of improper maintenance, it needs to be replaced at 23 years instead of 25. I think the representative may be asking, does that mean we disallow the entire replacement cost, even though really only, in a sense, 2/25 of that would be attributable to the improper maintenance? And I think that, I mean, that's a very good question. I think that the current bill literally read, could be read as having that effect. On the other hand, the committee will notice that the introductory language of the proposed paragraph 19 uses the phrase cost or that portion of the cost. Mm-hmm. And it's conceivable that the purpose of that phrase portion of the cost is to get a kind of an allocation of what portion of the costs are attributable to the improper maintenance versus the replacement cost that would be necessary in the ordinary course of events. And that this is a situation, this is something where we might benefit from legislative clarification as to what actually the intent of the sponsors is on this question, because, as I say, it could kind of be interpreted either way.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that that's, that I guess what we really do need is that clarification, because in the instance where we have a, if we had a piece of equipment that had exceeded its useful life, then is there any portion of that that is attributable, or if a, as in the instance that brought this all on, if there was a, another pipeline that's built and the objection is none of the new pipe can be capitalized out because it's replacing something that has been declared as wasn't maintained, and so I appreciate that, and I'd look forward to the guidance of the committee on figuring that out, because that's been a big concern for me.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. One of the explanations we heard early on that this language would help clarify, and we wouldn't have to depend so much on negligence or gross negligence to determine whether or not this would be a deductible situation. But I also heard in this explanation, unless I heard it incorrectly, that even if we went to a 225th scenario, I think what I heard you say was it would have to be determined what amount of maintenance contributed to that not being able to meet its full life. Is that going to be any less legally difficult to define or to defend as would negligence or gross negligence? So are we clarifying it one area and then creating murky waters in another? So I'm not sure. Could you help me out on that?
Mr. Chairman, this is Rob Mintz, if I may address that. Well, there are really two issues. One is what the legal standard is, and then second is what the facts show and evaluating the facts. Under any legal standard, the department's going to have to look at the facts and then under this bill consult with other agencies and apply the legal standard to the facts. And sometimes these are, especially if there's a lot of money at stake, there is going to be controversy about that, and it just has to be worked out in the course of administering the provisions of the bill. And I don't think really there's too much of a way to avoid that. But the question is, do we have sufficient clarity as to what the legal standard is? And the bill would make it clear that there's a broader legal standard in terms of disallowing costs than we have under the current law, because the current law essentially the standard is gross negligence, and if for example improper maintenance or lack of maintenance was due to something not quite as bad as gross negligence but imprudent conduct or ordinary negligence, then it would be more difficult to exclude that under the current standard than it would under the standard that this bill is proposing. So if we're interested in, as Mr. Iverson said, making the applicable standard more bulletproof, then that would be a benefit from the bill. Then again, the question of evaluating the facts under a particular circumstance would still be there, but we'd have a better standard from the standpoint of the policy that the legislature is interested in implementing.
Is it follow-up, if I may? As an attorney, do you think it would be difficult for someone to prove gross negligence if someone were to, say, just hypothetically, substitute water for corrosion in place of corrosion inhibitors, or put no corrosion inhibitors at all if that's what they were supposed to be using? I think that would certainly rise to the level of gross negligence, but what's your thoughts?
Mr. Chairman. Again, we're talking about applying the standard to the facts. I'm sure there are situations where the conduct or the failures or omissions on the part of a person are so egregious that it would be relatively easy to prove gross negligence. But gross negligence is definitely a narrower standard that would apply to fewer cases than either ordinary negligence or the kind of standard that's being proposed in this bill.
And the words improperly maintained, you know, just as a follow-up here, that's another tough one in that if you have certain sections of pipe, same fluids that didn't suffer corrosion, and a section that did suffer corrosion, was the pipe improperly maintained over its entire length, or only that part that actually we have the evidence for is subject to the improper maintenance rule, when downstream it doesn't seem to be suffering the same scenario? What would we do then if we were challenged on improper maintenance?
Mr. Chairman, I think this sort of raises a similar issue as Representative Seaton was asking about. That is, to what extent does the phrase portion of the cost in this bill, to what extent that's intended to provide for an allocation of cost between the costs that are actually due to the lack of maintenance and the cost that would be incurred in any event. I think, again, it's something that could benefit from guidance on the part of the legislature as to really what it intends.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on, we're talking about negligence and simple negligence, but that's not the standard that we're imposing here, to my reading. The standard is improper maintenance. And improper maintenance doesn't even need to be negligence. I mean, you can look at things and make decisions. I put oil in my car and I don't use, you know, Shell Rotella oil, which might be called for in the book. I use a different oil, which is basically the same and that's available to me. I make, you know, and that's not negligence, but if you went by a certain book, it might be improper maintenance. So what is the relationship that's going to be the bulletproof relationship, not in some cases, but in all cases, between improper maintenance and negligence? And can you tell me if those are equivalent terms?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Seaton, well, negligence is a very well-recognized concept in the law, and improper maintenance is something which is certainly newer to me, and I don't know that there's a lot of guidance out there, but it seems to me that the legislature could have decided to adopt a negligence standard, and by adopting something different, in this case, lack of or improper maintenance, I think that indicates a legislative intent to have a broader standard here, and instead of looking at the kind of the conduct of the standard of care that the operator or the producer is following, it just looks at the actual more or less the results, I would say, in terms of the maintenance practices or omissions, so I would think that it would be possible that costs would be excluded under the improper maintenance standard that would not necessarily be excluded under a negligence standard.
Go ahead, continue.
Just following up, so then improper maintenance and negligence are not identical terms here, and improper maintenance can cover many more things than negligence. So it's a much broader standard. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I don't know that I could quantify it as being much broader or somewhat broader, but I do think it is broader.
Very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Iverson, this state has a long history of litigation with the oil industry, and often it is simply to define some of these terms. And that is to much of my question. Has our relationship with the industry resulted in definitions of not maintained, improperly maintained, diminished capacity? Do we have a definition of standard practices of the industry, or, like the amendment says, good practices of the industry? Are there any definitions for these that are in place now that we could go to? Or are these all new fields of relationship between the state and the industry?
Through the chair, as far as the tax law is concerned in the state, we don't have those kinds of definitions. However, there is some jurisprudence in regard to good oil field practices, reasonable producer standards, those sorts of things. And I think that's probably more the purview of the Department of Natural Resources and the AOGCC, if you would like them to speak to that further, as to what actually is present out there as far as standards go that would address this sort of thing.
Give you a good time to give Mr. Iverson a break.
we've been asked to give you a brief recess and we'll maybe ask you to come back in a minute if that's okay.
Certainly, that's perfectly fine.
Good time to get coffee in the bathroom or whatever break you need.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So, John Norman, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is John Norman. I'm on the line.
I appreciate it. Always good to hear from you once again. Can you proceed with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission testimony?
Yes, sir. Thank you for the opportunity, again, to comment and talk to the committee. From the standpoint of the AOGCC, we've had some, I think, good substantive exchanges with the other agencies that are listed here. We're looking at this from the viewpoint of a law of general application that will have that will reach out into the years ahead, and that's the perspective we have, although we understand that there are some recent events that may be driving this. As I have said before, if the bill passes, we will do our utmost to implement it and make it work as smoothly as possible and do our part, and I want to also make that clear at the outset. Listening to the discussion, I'd like to offer just a simple, perhaps, framework that might help you think about this. Whenever you look at any actor or pattern of behavior of a person or a company, there are basically four categories that will fall into. One is an intentional or willful act. In other words, somebody intended to fire a rifle at the pipeline and blew a hole in it, and they intended it. A second is gross negligence or willful or wanton conduct. Generally considered to be conduct that's done in careless disregard of the consequences. A third level down from that is negligence, or before this committee on another bill, the term was used, simple negligence, and I would accept that, or ordinary negligence, common negligence. And then finally, there's a category of strict liability, meaning we don't care why you did it, what led up to it. If it happened, you're liable. And I think one member of the committee indicated that this is more whatever the result is, liability is assigned. In looking at this bill, as we would have to, and trying to think about how we might implement it here, the first two that I have identified, the first two categories, intentional and willful acts, or secondly, gross negligence, are presently in the bill already under 6. So they're picked up there. The fourth category, strict liability, at least a portion of that is picked up under subsection 16, where for whatever reason it would happen, the costs of containment, control, removal, et cetera, are picked up again. So that leaves us with category number three, which is negligence. And that is the way to look at it. And I did appreciate the discussion that occurred before now, because I think if someone were to look at this and try to fathom the intent of the legislature, you'd try to fit it into one of those four categories. One and two are already addressed in the bill, so you must not mean willful or gross. And number four is already addressed, at least partially, in 16, the strict liability. So I think an argument could be made, as indicated by Mr. Mintz, that what you're talking about here is disallowing disallowing property not properly maintained or that was negligently maintained. Normally, in gross negligence, it often leaps out at you, and the obvious cases and situations will sort themselves out. And in going through the filter of the different sections in this bill, I think they'll be screened out by number six. As we get to 19, it is going to be more difficult, because I believe that we are talking about ordinary negligence, although I certainly don't presume to know that, because the legislature is the authority on this. And in the years ahead, people will spend time trying to discern your intent. If you did say negligently maintained, that would end the discussion right there. We would know. If you don't say that and leave it that it's improperly maintained, then it does leave open somewhat the question about, were you describing a category of negligence, or did you mean it more broadly, which might even move into strict liability? I simply raise that as a simple framework of thinking about it, because as time goes by, I think people are going to be thinking through this, trying to discern what the intent was and fit it into the categories. And they'll try to put it into some pigeonhole, and as much help as we could get would be appreciated.
I was hoping for the reverse.
Well, then what I would suggest is that if it is the intention only to penalize negligent maintenance but not impose a strict liability, meaning if anything goes wrong, we're going to disallow the deduction, then it might be better to use the word negligence for clarity. Secondly, I believe it's been brought to the committee's attention that there have been some discussions, and that the words good oil field practices are preferred, certainly by the AOGCC, and it's my understanding, likewise, by DNR and Revenue. Those terms already appear in Alaska law, specifically in one section, 3105.170.15, and then a number of places in our regulations. We believe it's a more objective standard and a bit more precise. It's a more normative-oriented standard than one that would say standard practices of the industry, which might invite you to just look and see what other people in an oil field were doing. And it is conceivable that the prevailing number of operators there were all operating not in accordance with good oil field practices, but if they were all doing it, you might get the argument that this is standard practice here. And I could quickly cite a number of oil fields in the world where we believe the practices are certainly not up to what we would consider good oil field practices. Another point that I would like to make, and these are things that I'm just trying to help to be helpful to think this out, is that on the replacement, if it is determined that a particular component, whatever it is, a compressor, a gasket, whatever, a pipeline has a certain useful life, and it may go up there, we all know that that's not necessarily exact, and consequently, this could be inviting early replacement of component parts where they might actually have a more functional life. We, in a letter sent, also indicated that when this is implemented by regulation, which I would think it would be if the legislature passes this, then at least certainly the AOGCC would contemplate promulgating some regulations, and there we would try to implement this in a way and describe regulations that at least would not discourage innovation, pioneering of new techniques, production methodologies, that it may take some years to figure out that this doesn't work. The last point that I will make, Mr. Chairman, is that under 19B, subsection B, I want to point out a policy consideration there that is perhaps slightly different than that articulated by some of the other agencies. There, subsection A denies the cost of repair and replacement of the property not properly maintained or improperly maintained. Subsection B then denies the cost of an operational shutdown of the entire facility that occurred as a result of improper maintenance. And in our view, we think it would be very prudent to think about that as a matter of policy, because often operators are reacting to an event. We believe that they should be allowed and perhaps even are owed a certain amount of latitude in how they respond to it. They're the ones that are going to be responsible for the consequences. And if the decision is made that the most prudent, safe, efficient way to approach this repair or replacement is to shut down the facility for a certain